the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanti Show. On today's episode, Sean is joined by Tobias Bakel at the North American Science Fiction Convention, which was recently held in San Juan, Puerto Rico. This was a live recording, so please excuse the audio. And at the end, you will hear questions from audience members that attended the panel. Thank you so much for listening, and we hope you enjoy it.
Okay, so again, we want to get this started?
Yeah, let's get this party started.
Okay, so obviously there's a bunch of equipment, so I'm recording it for my podcast, because why not? So the way it'll work, I'll start, introduce yourselves and all that kind of stuff. I'll ask a bunch of questions, and then I'll open it to you, and you guys can ask questions as you please. Don't ask for a social security number, because that might be some problems. We'll get to why. I have a question about that later.
Okay. So. I'm always happy to answer any question you have, and if it's a question that I don't feel comfortable answering, I'll just say, I'm sorry I don't feel comfortable answering that. So I will not be offended by any question you ask. You might as well go ahead and throw it out there.
Well, perfect. All right, so let's just get started.
That includes you too, Sean.
I mean, I try not to ask. I've got a question here about your time at the Pentagon, but I don't think you can actually tell us about
that. No comment.
Yeah, so.
I don't recall.
You don't recall. So what I'll do is start with, we know you like write some stuff or whatever, but for folks that don't know you, maybe you could give like a quick introduction. Who is Tobias Bakel?
Who is Tobias Bakel? Hi, my name is Tobias Bakel, it rhymes with hell. I grew up in Grenada and the U.S. and British Virgin Islands. I was born to a family that has a lot of experience living aboard and sailing boats. My grandfather was the person who kind of started that on the English side of my family. He bought a boat and put it on the Thames and enjoyed the process so much. He bought a bigger boat, sold his business, moved the whole family onto the boat, and set off to explore the world by sea. And because inevitably people ask, how did you end up living on a boat in the Caribbean as a child? So my mom's side of the family ended up sailing across the Atlantic and living up and down the Caribbean after my mom spent a brief period of time in New Zealand. She really likes Lord of the Rings, by the way. Taste of home. My mom met my biological father in Grenada, and the Grenadian side of my family descends from a Grenadian fisherman who sail and fish and live scattered throughout the Grenadines. So I'm related to like the entire north tip of Grenada, large parts of Petite Martinique, Carriacou, and places like that. The sort of Grenadines are this place between St. Vincent and Grenada, a little chain of islands inside of a chain of islands. Very beautiful, some of the most beautiful water and sailing areas in the world. Grenada, for those of you who don't know, is almost at the very southernmost tip of the Caribbean chain, north of South America. It's not quite as far down as Trinidad and Tobago, which almost look like they're in Venezuela. It's just a bit north of that. After Grenada, my mom and my dad became estranged, and so we moved to the Virgin Islands, which was where my British side of the family had ended up settling, and so my mom rejoined her family for the first time in 10 or 15 years and met up there. So I went to school all throughout the Virgin Islands until I was a senior in high school, and then I ended up in Ohio because my stepdad is from Akron, Ohio, and married my mom. We moved to Akron. We moved to Akron after a really bad hurricane season in 1995. So I'm very familiar with the Puerto Rico area because the Virgin Islands is basically 100 miles directly east of where we are right now, probably more like 80. actually.
Have you sailed that before?
I have sailed that before, yes.
Is it scary?
No.
No? Okay. large bodies of water, for me, a little terrifying, but you know.
You know what was terrifying to me as a child?
What?
Earthquakes. I was reading, like, when I was learning how to read, and I had this early textbook, I think in first grade, maybe in kindergarten, there was this textbook we had, and it had probably been first grade, there was this textbook, and it showed an earthquake as the ground splitting, and fire and boiling lava being underneath it, and people screaming, and someone falling into the crack. And I thought, Jesus Christ, who wants to walk on Earth? It could open up and swallow you at any given moment. You know? Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Like, you know, at least on the water, I know I'm on a floating object.
Okay, fair point. Well, I was going to ask you about, like, this whole deal about you living in Ohio, but you just explained it, so we'll skip on to talking about books.
I can elaborate further if more pieces of that interest you, but sure.
It's just a very interesting thing when you say, I've been to all these islands and all this stuff, and then it's like, and now I live in Ohio.
And now I live in Ohio. You know, Ohio is usually a place that I meet a lot of people who have come from it. I'm one of the relatively few, the proud, who have moved to it. Me and John Scalzi and Cameron Hurley, all writers, people I know who've moved to Ohio, all for similar reasons, you know.
Because it's cheap.
It's very cheap. It's very easy to sort of make a living writing there. I mean, I live in a town where you can find houses for $70,000 to $100,000. You know, my mortgage is extraordinarily cheap. Labor is also cheap. Out where I live too, because it's a very economically distressed area. Of course, like, that's not like huge selling points, but it makes it easy for me to sort of be a freelancer and a writer in that area. I mean, that sounds like I planned it out that way. It wasn't. I went to college there because my stepdad is very religious, and also I'm the first person in my either side of my British or my Grenadian side of the family, as far as I know, to go to college. In terms of my immediate Grenadian family, you know, I'm only just now reconnecting with a lot of my cousins. I have 39 cousins.
That's a lot of cousins.
So on my Grenadian side, and 4 on my British side. It's kind of, you know, 10-to-1 ratio there. I'm only just now getting to meet a lot of my cousins, but as far as I knew, there was no tradition of going to college in either of my families in terms of received wisdom that I had growing up. And so when I was in the States, you know, most of my family on the English side, and also a lot of family on the Grenadian side, are all kind of like entrepreneurial. And I just figured I would, you know, buy a boat when I was senior, you know, in school, and take tourists out on day trips snorkeling, and in my spare time write. I mean, I thought that was my future. I thought that's what I would do with my time. I was working on my Coast Guard captain's license when I was a senior and junior in high school. So I was logging my hours in a logbook because that was my goal, was to take the captain's test, and that was how I was going to make my living, earn my shingle. When I was moved to the States against my will, I mean, and really I was kind of terrified about moving to the States because I knew a lot about the States from watching movies. But mostly what terrified me about moving to the States was that's where all the tourists came from. And no fault to tourists, but when you're on vacation, you're not exactly the shining beacon of your people, right? When you're on vacation, you're like rum punch, mistakes that I'll regret later, stupid buying decisions, and being as lazy as you can, all of which is fine. I'm the same way on vacation, okay? However, when that's all you encounter of people, like, all I knew about people from the U.S. mainly was that I met them on vacation, and it was like, wow, I'm going to the land of where these people come from. What'll that be like? I am being somewhat, I'm joking, but not as much as you'd think. So I was really kind of nervous about the cultural transition. Also, you know, coming from a multicultural, much more cosmopolitan sort of area, a port city, which is where I live, to living in the Midwest was a huge adjustment. But mainly, I didn't know how to make a living when I landed in the States. I was an entrepreneur when I was growing up. I made money on the side all the time. I always had a side hustle. When I arrived in the States, someone was like, do you want to mouse some hay for some extra money? Sure. Man, I spent a backbreaking day throwing hay around a farm and they gave me 15 bucks and I worked sun up to sundown. I was like, this is not for me. So I decided to go to college 2 weeks before college started, just on a I can't work at McDonald's anymore kind of desperate gamble. And I didn't have enough money to get back to the islands to start my life as a, you know, someone working on boats. So I went to college for 4 years and worked on writing and started to break into to print and all that good stuff, and ended up staying in the town just because that I had humongous student debt, and my stepdad really encouraged me to go to this really small private religious college. That didn't work in any way. I'm not religious in any way, but I ended up staying in the town for you know, almost 20 years now.
Wow, okay. So so I want to switch us over to talking about your work, because you kind of already leading us there a bit, right? You went to college, you started to write, started to get published. You've written a lot of stuff in terms of the kinds of genres you write, and we just learned in your reading, right, you're working on epic fantasy and Second World fantasy, all this kind of stuff. So I'm curious what you see as a writer. What were the challenges of, like, going in all these different directions with your writing?
So, yeah, I don't know if I mean, who am I as a writer? Like, that's kind of what you're getting at. And that's such a hard question, because I got published really young, so I've been figuring this all out as I go along, like, in public with everyone. You know, there wasn't like I had, like, you know, 15 years to kind of think about what motivated me the most and what my brand identity would be as a writer. I just knew I was going to be a writer more than anything in the world. I started when I was in seventh grade, somewhere between seventh and eighth grade, I think, that summer was when it kind of lit up in my head that I was going to become a writer, damn it. And that's when I started telling people, you know, like when people ask you, like, you know, what do you think you're going to be when you grow up? And it's like, I'm going to be a writer. I mean, yeah, I was going to be a boat captain that, like, sailed people around and you know, took them snorkeling at Buck Island and whatever. But, like, in the back of my head, that was, like, the day job platform that would give me the time to write on the side. Because, one of the charter boats I worked on, he worked, like, 3 or 4 days a week, you know, and so I thought, like, that's not bad. Like, if I work, like, 3 days to 4 days, you know, the fourth day was sometimes on and off, but if I work a real solid 3 days a week and then I have 4 days a week to write, I'm like, it looks good to me. So starting in the end of seventh grade, I started writing really seriously and sending stuff off to be published.
At seventh grade.
The Writers of the Future competition, the anthologies had made it all the way down to some of the small grocery bookstores on the way back home from school towards the dinghy I took to get to my boat. That's how I went to school. People often ask that question, so I answered that in anticipation. And I had read one of the writers, I read two or three of the Writers of the Future competition books from like fifth grade to seventh grade, and in the back, there are details on how to submit. And that was the first time it kind of occurred to me that you could submit work. So I started submitting in seventh grade. Incidentally, one of my classmates is Tiffany Anik. She is she writes fantastic fiction, magical realism. And we are like the two Virgin Islands novelists.
Interesting.
She also had it in her head that she should start submitting. So we also kind of wonder, you know, we did an interview together and we kind of wondered maybe there was also some confidence that came from our school or our teachers. You know, for some reason, both of us thought, even though we didn't know each other was doing it, that, like, yeah, it seems only natural that we should start submitting our work. We are, of course, that great. completely unearned self-confidence in my part. My classmate Tiffany Anik won a number of local competitions. She got to meet Maya Angelou and get given an award for her poetry. So she was definitely a clear up-and-coming star. I was the nerdy white kid in the class writing science fiction and going, like, this is excellent. And submitting it to the Writers of the Future competition and just waiting for the thousands of dollars of prize money to roll in, which it didn't, surprisingly, in seventh grade. So I got my first rejection and kind of, like, went back to the drawing board and thought, well, maybe I need to try again. And I kept trying every single quarter all the way through high school, and I started getting books about how to write, how to submit, subscribe [S2] Sure. [S1] To Writers Magazine. And particularly once I got to the States, was able to find just a plethora of books from libraries that were about how to write and how and writers, the writer's market guide, things like that, which were really useful. As who I am as a writer, obviously, like, you know, from my perspective, I'm flailing around constantly trying to figure that out, and I'm kind of lost in the darkness. Externally, a friend of mine, a fellow writer from the Caribbean, just read all of my stuff before a thing we were going to do, and all of my short fiction, and she laughed and she said, you know, even when you don't think you're writing about the Caribbean, it's still all there, and I see what you're doing. She's like, you can take the boy out of the Caribbean, but I'm not quite sure you're taking the Caribbean out of the boy. So, you know, when I sit down and think about it, like, even my, you know, most science fictional, least Caribbean-looking stuff is often inspired by work I'm reading from the Caribbean or history of the Caribbean, and I'm trying to process that, and I'm just, you know, using science fictional trappings to kind of work through that. And so I think a large part of my identity and as a writer is this white-looking, mixed-race kid who grew up in Grenada in the middle of a revolution and then an invasion, and who's moved up and down the Caribbean trying to figure out what all that can mean and what how power works, how nationality works, how borders work, how political systems work.
Yeah.
What it's like to be a small group of people in a wider, scarier universe that is more powerful than you, with through which currents and things move that you don't have a lot of effect over. And what kind of identity and culture and art do you build to respond to that? And I think that's basically what I'm always playing with.
Yeah, this is something that I saw that you brought up last night in the opening ceremonies, that when you talked about how excited you are to be here in Puerto Rico, saying you feel somewhat kind of like, you kind of identify with this, the island, because of the way it's sort of situated between these things, and that's very much your life, which we just kind of heard, right, being in Ohio, but also being from these islands, and the islands with various relationships to other former or current empires, depending on your perspective. And it's interesting, because you're right, all of your work, right, in some ways is dealing with this, the Xenowelt Saga, very much about empire.
Yes.
Right? Explicitly. Very much about empire. And even, like, Arctic Rising, to some degrees, is also about that, because you have the kind of jostling of power. But you're dealing with it at very different scales, which I find really interesting. So when you went from space opera to, I guess, eco-thrillers?
Yeah, let's see. I like eco-thriller.
Eco-thrillers? Like, did you find that constricting to suddenly go from something where you could basically go anywhere you wanted to stuck on the globe?
No, I didn't feel it constricting at all. It just is a change of focus and a change of what is lighting you up. So in Arctic Rising, I was very interested in loss of empire through not paying attention to changes in the world. So, you know, one of the things that Arctic Rising has is a very large absence of American force projection in the Arctic, which is the U.S. has a less force projection into the Arctic than Sweden does. Sweden has more military icebreakers and military ships capable of going into the Arctic than the U.S. does. Russia has the most right now. So, like, Sweden is more of a military counterbalance to Russia in the Arctic navally than we are. And the Arctic is rapidly becoming an area where nations, you know, people are talking about the Arctic Tigers, which is Norway, Sweden, Finland, Russia, Canada, right?
Huh.
It's a new sphere of power that people need to think about. You know, just like the Chinese Sea is a sphere of naval area, the Indian Ocean, you know, the Atlantic Ocean,
sure,
right, and the general Pacific. Well, right now, the Arctic is being paid attention to by those nations, but the U.S. has a tremendous amount of coastline there through Alaska, and it's doing very little to build up or pay attention to it. So I just sort of was just kind of playing with how you can lose influence on a global scale in that book, as well as all the other stuff I was doing.
Yeah, dealing with things like climate change as
well.
And it's interesting too, because, right, you're dealing in Arctic Rising very much with the Arctic side of it, but then when you come back to Hurricane Fever, you go back to the Caribbean in a very explicit way. And I thought it was interesting you mentioned one of the factors in your life that it kind of was a big thing was the hurricane.
Yeah.
You had, and hurricane fever, if the title didn't give it away, right? There is like this massive
hurricane. Spoiler.
Yeah. Well, I kind of don't feel like it ruins. It happens pretty early, but it is like, it's obviously a huge fixture in that.
It is.
It's something that's accelerated by very much what is going on now.
Hurricane Fever is like the most personal novel I've written to date, which doesn't say a lot necessarily, but it is the novel that I kind of, you know, very explicitly place it on boats for the most part, which is a big part of my life and how I grew up. It is, you know, centers around the way hurricanes change trajectories of lives, and it's set all up and down the Caribbean. And so that, you know, that's all stuff that really, you know, speaks to me.
Are you thinking you're a little bit of Rue? Is that
no, actually. No. Rue is way cooler than I could ever be.
He's like a super spy in the book.
Yeah.
I think that's the best way to say.
Sure, yeah. Sure. He's a freelance Caribbean spy.
Yeah, he's pretty much awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, so no, not you. Alright, well, we'll move past that one then, I guess. But anyway, so we kind of looked at space opera, you've looked at sort of the eco-thriller side, but you've also done tie-in work, right, with the Halo books, one of which I have here, which is your most recent one from this year. Can you say a little bit, how did that happen?
How did that happen?
Yeah,
so, that happened because I play a lot of Halo. So when I was writing my first books with Tor, the Caribbean space operas, Crystal Rain, Ragamuffin, Sly Mongoose, they were a lot of fun, and one of the things that allowed me to do was to go visit Tor and see Tor itself, because it's like the largest producer of science fiction in the field.
And it's in the Flatiron.
And it's in the Flatiron building. So I loved finding excuses to go to New York and hang out with people at Tor and meet people in person. I love meeting people in person. I'm mildly extroverted. So going to Tor was a lot of fun, and one of the things I did was I met a younger editor. I started publishing these books when I was like 24, 25, which meant that like almost all of my colleagues are like 10 to 15 years older than me, and always have been. It's only just now recently I'm starting to meet a lot of writers from their late 20s and 30s, and it's really exciting to actually meet fellow professionals who are my age. So when I was out there, I ran into this editor who was roughly my age, Eric Robb, and he and I were kind of like, dude, you know, and we hung out a little bit, you know, went out for drinks, that kind of thing after my visits at Tor. So he knew what video games I liked because he also played video games, and we talked about stuff like that. So he got to be editor for the Halo novels at Tor when they moved over to Tor.
Oh.
So one of the days, you know, one day he just kind of swung by when I was hanging out at Tor, and he's like, hey, this is a long shot, but like, you know, I know you play a lot of different video games. Do you play Halo? So backstory, the reason I have an Xbox is because of Halo. So I was a PS2 guy, and still love PS, but I got the Xbox because at the time, Xbox was doing some really great things with online multiplayer and co-op, which I was really interested in doing because I was at that phase where I graduated college and all my buddies had split away geographically. And so the Xbox was this great way to kind of continue that dorm room kind of like, you know, player-to-player gaming and talking over the headset and keeping up with your friends. So I started like hanging out with some friends and playing like Left 4 Dead and Halo 3 online a ton. And so much so that, like, you know, my wife called Halo back then, the other wife. So when he asked me if I was willing to write a Halo book, I was just like, hell yeah, that would be a lot of fun. So he tossed my books into a package that he sent over to Bungie and said, like, hey, this guy would be interested in writing for the IP. And they came back and they're like, wow, we really liked Crystal Rain. So it'd be really fun to see what he could do with a Halo novel. And so, yeah, all of a sudden I was flying out to Bungie headquarters and like taking a tour of the whole place and meeting all the people who came up with the game. And then we had this like great big conference room meeting where they sat down and they're like, okay, well, let us explain what Halo is to you, the people who are assigned to shepherd me through. So they sat down and they started to like give me the basics. And I was kind of like, hold on just a second. And I was kind of like, so here are all my questions I have about the background of the universe. And after I kind of vomited at them for a bit, they're like, okay, what do you want to write? So I was kind of like, okay, so here's my rough idea for a book I'd like to write. And when I was done, they were like, okay, that sounds good. You should go do that.
Which is a question I had, was about how much control you actually... Because usually with media tie-ins, depending on the company, right, there's differing degrees of control that the author gets. But it seems that you had quite a lot of free reign.
I had quite a lot of free reign with the first one. They were really nice to me. They were very comfortable. Like I said, once I showed that, like, actually I played the game a ton, they were like, oh, okay. They thought I was kind of a... You know, I think maybe some of the people who were briefing me in the room may have assumed that I was just coming in as a science fiction writer. And that they needed to explain the game. But I came in first as a Halo player, writer second. I thought at the very least I'm going to just get a tour of Bungie, even if they don't choose me for writing the book, right? Free tour of Bungie on someone else's nickel. Oh, yeah, let's do it. Sure. There's this like 8-foot tall statue of Master Chief in the lobby, and I regret not getting a picture, you know, with it. But
there's still time.
There's still time. Bungie, you listen to this? So they just were a lot of fun to work with. I mean, the only wrinkle at the time was that they were in the process of pulling themselves out from Microsoft Game Studio and becoming 343. And so there was a lot of, you know, who do you ask questions were being figured out as I was writing the book. Those were the only wrinkles, and that's only natural. And everything was figured out, and I had a great amount of fun writing it. For the second book, they had a more formal process in place, so there were people that were assigned to me that were great. They would answer questions immediately. They had a little bit more input in terms of not demanding what I wrote, but just saying like, hey, is there a way you could write about this aspect of the universe and fold it in? Actually, it was an aspect that I was absolutely willing to and psyched to go explore. So it was something that, it wasn't a bolt-on. They were just like, hey, this is something that we think Bungie fans would really appreciate seeing something about. And I was like, you know, as a Bungie fan, I've always wondered about that. And they're like, well, you get to make it all up now. And it's just kind of like, sweet.
You got a good job. Yeah. And then you became a New York Times best-selling author.
That was
a thing.
A bonus, yeah. As John Scalzi said, you get to put a new first name on to your existing name. You know?
Yep, it's and like, every book
longer,
now.
Yeah, from now on, you're New York Times bestselling author, Tobias Bakel. That was really wild. I wish I had more time to enjoy it. I'd just gotten out of the hospital for a heart defect at the time, and I'd been hospitalized, and so like when it came out, I was still kind of in a post-recovery days. But I started to realize it was a thing when, you know, I would go to the grocery store, you know, Meijer or Kroger, and there my book would be in the regular, you know, like it's weird to see your book in the grocery store or at Best Buy. I went to Best Buy to buy some electronics, and my wife kind of nudged me and was like, look, and there my book was next to all the video games, you know, and I was just like, what? So it was just everywhere there for like, you know, 2 months. Everywhere I went, there was my book, something I'd written. And that was a wild experience, and I hope maybe someday to have that again in my life in terms of that.
When you're healthy.
When I'm healthy and I can be like, oh yeah, that's my book. Look, it's my book. At the time, I was really low on energy and just sort of like, there's my book. Holy crap, I know I should be appreciating this, but I just want to go home and take a nap.
Yep.
But yeah, it was really wild to see all that happen.
Awesome. Okay, so one quick question, then I want to turn it to the audience, because I know we're getting close towards the end of our slot. But I have been reliably informed by the Pentagon that you are working on a new novel.
I am.
And then you, I guess, broke protocol and told us about it and then read from it in your reading a little earlier.
I did.
Which, I guess you're not planning to go home, but it's called The Tangled Lands, and you co-wrote it with Paolo Bacigalupi, where you like half and halfy half, but it's coming out in February, and I want you to tell us a little bit about this book, what we should expect.
Sure. The Tangled Lands is a novel set in a world where magic has a price, and the price is something called Bramble. Bramble is an after effect of magic. You cast a spell, you try to save your dying child, you know, try to heal a wound, you know, try to make a magical weapon. It'll cause these little brambles to pop up somewhere. It might not even be right where you're standing, it might be somewhere else in town. And that pops up, a little bit pops up every time someone uses magic. Bramble is sort of feathery, spiky, soft thistle that if you brush it, touch it, and one strand gets you, it'll put you to sleep, like, you know, Sleeping Beauty, put you into a deep sleep. Touch a lot of it, you go into a coma, and eventually die, right? But you don't necessarily, you die of the processes that catch up to you because you've been in a coma. And this has brought down empires because they've used tons of magic to gain an edge, or people have just become so used to using magic in their everyday life that it just causes Bramble to spread everywhere, and it just thickens and grows up and chokes, whole lands. And the way in which people respond to it, is basically what our book is about. Our book is about particularly a city, an area which is responding to, this stuff.
Infection or something.
So the Tangled Lands are, the areas being covered by Bramble, and how different societies react to it, and how different people try to skirt the laws against using magic, or, how to grab power for themselves by gaining access to using magic while not allowing others to use it, and so forth and so on.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, this would be exciting.
Yeah, and it's a lot of fun. Paolo and I had a lot of fun coming up with this world and writing about it and creating the different stories that take place in it, and it's been a labor of love. It's been really cool because it's one of those secret passion projects. We've never had as such deadlines or contracts to write these books. We've just been kind of working on them in our spare time and passing ideas back and forth, and it's kind of fun to be collaborative, because usually you're just a writer in your own little world, and it's been really fun to have a collaborator in the best sense of the word, in terms of just like coming up with ideas to try and make the other person go like, oh, that's completely evil, or that's really funny, or this is really shocking and fun to read. So it's one of the really fun moments of the last few years has been like working on that with him over time.
Yeah, emphasis on last year. Would you say? Okay, so we have some time for questions from the audience. So anyone got questions for Tobias?
Yeah.
I can come closer.
Okay.
For the purpose of your recording.
Oh, well, thank you.
I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about your process for writing, kind of like how you structure your day, and how you kind of approach, a deadline.
To approach a deadline, what I basically do is I try to break down how many days I have on the clock, and how many words the project's going to be, and then think like, okay, so you need time to rewrite. So I'm a big believer in breaking things down into concrete, daily achievable goals, and trying to define what that means for you. So to write a novel means, it's going to be roughly 100,000 words. So you need to break that down into some kind of daily unit that you can definitely achieve, whatever that is. Is it 200 words? Is it 500 words? Or is it, do you think in terms of pages? Do you think in terms of hours? Every writer is really different. What works for me is words. I tend to be like word oriented. So I tend to, when I start a project, go like, okay, my focus is to get 500 words each day until it's done, that way I know that if I just set aside, okay, the first thing I have to do today is write 500 words, then I find that time and space that right away lets me kind of do that. That's the ideal structure that I set up for myself. Let's talk about reality. Reality is that a novel is this like really amorphous thing, right? I mean, it's not widget making. I'm not stamping out objects. So it's really sometimes hard to follow that, because you can write 500 words a day really rigorously and write the wrong 10,000 words if you're doing the wrong thing. And so a lot of novel writing involves kind of sitting around thinking about whether or not what I've done is any good, and daydreaming and coming up with better ideas. For really strict items, I tend to try and abide by some kind of daily schedule and some kind of deadline, and meeting that deadline. I tend to like to work in on-off bursts. And so, for example, the first chunk of a novella I wrote not that long ago, a couple years ago, was written in 10 days, and I wrote you know, 15,000 words in 10 days and really liked that. And actually, no, it was 15,000 words in like 5 days and then like days to kind of like play with what I had. So the older I get and the longer I've done this, the more hippie I get in terms of just saying like, you know, I try lots of different things and see what works, right? And I've grown comfortable with the idea that what works changes from project to project. So sometimes I have a novel where just religiously doing 500 words a day because I have a really strong outline and I have a really strong sense of what the novel has to be works out really well for me, and I can predict to you when I'm going to finish the novel, when I'm going to hit deadline, and what I'm going to have at the end of it. And sometimes I will put off writing something for a year and then sit down and write it in like a couple months. Sometimes I will write half of something and then hit a block and go like, okay, I need to stop and just really spend like 3 weeks thinking about what I have and then coming up with an action plan for how I finish the rest of it. And sometimes I work on passion projects that are just in the background and they just get moved along a little bit at a time whenever I have time to work on it. And my process changes every 3 or 4 years as I learn and bring on different tools and try different things. So even though I've done a very, I don't want to say mechanical, because I've really enjoyed what I've done with some of the rigorous writing schedules I've had. But one of the things I'm looking to do recently is I've always done one project at a time. Because when I started writing, I was surrounded by people who started new projects all the time and didn't finish jack, right? And so one of the things I told myself was, I don't want to be a non-finisher. I want to be a finisher. And so I set a rule for myself at the beginning of my career all these years ago that I would finish every project I started, because I didn't want to succumb to, I'm ADD, I didn't want to succumb to these things I was seeing with other writers who every week I talked to them and they were like, I have a great new idea, it's the best idea in the world. I'm like, man, I've got a best new idea of the world every single day of my life. Actually, every 15 minutes I have a best new idea. I spend most of my life trying to ignore my best new ideas. So when I write, I just said, even if the better idea comes along, I'm going to keep working on the initial shitty idea that I had just to be a finisher. Always be finishing. I was kind of like, you know, that little Alec Baldwin, you know, always be selling. I was kind of like, always be finishing. And that has served me really well, and I'm grateful for the success I've had. I'm now going to try doing something where I try to work on projects that I'm passionate about, and when that passion fades, move to another project, and then when the passion fades for that, move back to the other project. I've read some writers who do that, and I've seen some really good results from people doing that, and I'm going to cautiously experiment with doing that in the years ahead. I'm particularly inspired by Asimov, who I read used to have a U-shaped desk, and he would have 10 typewriters. Okay? And so he would work on one typewriter until he ran out of what he was doing, and then he would be like, okay, there's no energy left for this project, and then he would just like move the chair over, you know, a foot, and then just like get on the next typewriter and start writing on that typewriter until he'd kind of run out of steam on whatever that was, and then he'd like go eat lunch, and then he'd come back and he'd like start up on the next typewriter, and he'd just keep rotating around and until, you know, to whatever project caught his fancy. I'm really intrigued by that and would like to try that out with some short fiction and novellas, as well as the novel projects I'm working on, and see overall, because I religiously track all the words I produce and how much time I spend writing on an Excel spreadsheet. And I'm sort of kind of curious to see what the chart of you know, productivity looks like doing that versus doing this other thing. And if that doesn't work out, I'll go back to doing the other thing. My whole life is to, my whole life I've worked on a principle of try lots of different things, but track the process and outcomes so that I'm not lying to myself.
Right.
And so if I have a theory about how I might be more effective as a writer, I test it out. This sounds really mechanical and soulless, but actually it enables me to be very creatively artistic, because I will try the dumbest things in the world even if they're things that I'm kind of like, I'm so opposed to this crazy hippie sounding idea. But I will try it, and I will keep track of it, and I'll write about it and keep a journal about it and put spreadsheet tracking of it, and I'll see how it affects me. I track when my golden hours are. I tag when I write so I can see, like, oh, look, turns out that I can vomit 2,000 words if I start writing at midnight, like, predictably. And when I write in the morning, it's just like pulling teeth, right? You know, so I know a lot about myself as a writer because it's all in spreadsheets. Again, it sounds soulless, but again, it means I know thyself. And these are all just ways to get me to write more.
Yeah, it's like a pretty easy word of advice, which is finding the system that works for you.
Yeah.
You can't do that if you're not willing to try stuff.
Right, right. So I'm constantly iterating and giving myself permission to know that I might change and that that's okay. So right now, this novel I'm writing,
sure.
This new novel I'm writing from scratch, and I'm writing a new epic fantasy. And what I'm doing is actually I'm not keeping track of how long it takes me to write it on a daily basis or the word count. I'm just writing the damn thing. I will pay attention to how many days overall it'll take me to write it, and I'll know how many words I have at the end. But I'm not tracking anything about daily word count. I'm not tracking how I'm going about writing it that precisely. I'm just noodling around and writing, working on it as inspiration strikes. And I'm curious to see how that process works. And I'll keep a daily journal about that in writing and see what the outcome is. And maybe
cool.
this sort of like goofy Lucy way of noodling my way into a book will work better. I don't know.
Well, we will see. Yeah.
Somewhat disciplined writer, or very disciplined writer, would you say your word output has increased over the years, or has it sort of plateaued?
My word output is less than when I was in my 20s. I think that's a function of like the general enthusiasm of being in my 20s. I'm now in my 30s, and I have 2 kids and a health condition. I turned 30 and found out I had a heart defect. I think that has more of an impact on my writing than other changes in my life, which is just simply that like I have different energy levels than I used to prior to that. But I'm right now going through a period of I got cleared by my cardiologist to work out and run and lift weights again. So for the last year, I've been trying to change my health levels, and that's starting to have an impact on my energy levels, which is starting to have an impact on my productivity levels. So I'm starting to write more and do more and be more creative and come up with more projects in the last like 6 months than I have been over the past 5 years. And that's having a big impact on me. And so that, I'm anticipating that my 40s might actually, I'm 38 right now. I'm anticipating that my late 30s and my 40s might actually be more productive than my 30s. And I'm willing to bet, because I'm a more seasoned individual, and the fact that my kids are then going to be a little bit older. I mean, when they were younger, they took up a lot of time, as they should. But as they get to teenage years, they're probably not going to want to have anything to do with me. I'm probably going to have a lot more time on my hands to write. So I'm guessing my 40s are going to be far more productive than my 30s or 20s.
Ask Scalzi about that, because he has a teenage daughter. Yeah.
Well, and he seems to be writing quite a bit, so
I think
I have things to look forward to.
Yeah, please.
Since you come from a sailing family, has any of them ever participated in the America's Cup?
No, they have not, alas.
Okay, we got time for one more quick question.
Okay.
Yes, please.
I was sort of curious, you mentioned that the book that's coming out, you're co-writing it with Alabama Chigalupi. I was wondering how the collaborative process differs for you from your regular writing process.
It's way more kind of like a, you know, hanging out at a bar with a good friend, you know, throwing ideas back and forth. Excuse me. It's different in that, like, you know, you have to please someone else. And so it's really interesting kind of negotiating, you know, like when I create a world, I get to do anything I want, even if it's a dumb idea. And when you're collaborating, you have to kind of explain yourself. And that's really interesting. So, like, you know, in many instances, it'll be like, you know, someone, you know, usually when you write a novel, you get it to the editor, and then the editor kind of like, you know, why does this happen? Why is this going on? But when it's someone you've co-created the world with and they're asking that same question, you know, you can't There's no way you can kind of be like, oh, it's just because I want it that way. Like you're kind of like, well, I was thinking X, Y, Z, and you kind of have to justify yourself a bit more. So it forces you to think through why you're doing something that you're doing a lot more. And I think that was really good for me artistically, creatively. It certainly helped me become a better world builder in terms of trying to think through how to bring more depth and coherency to the world I was showing. So the other thing that's just different about it is that you spend a lot of time chatting and world building with someone before you set out to write the stuff. So a lot of Skype conversations and a lot of in-person conversations with Paolo that were really energizing is something completely different, that were really energizing. And I actually took that and brought it back to my process of writing this new novel, because I found that having those discussions about the world, thinking through implications of the world, and discussing them with another person was really valuable to giving a depth to the world we were creating. And it's something that I've done in my writing before, but not nearly to that extent. And so working on my new project, I've been having a kind of like co-writer collaboration conversation with myself out loud and on paper before writing this new novel. And I've been doing a lot of, as I go along, kind of trying to justify to myself, as if I were having a conversation with a collaborator, why I'm doing certain things. In fact, I'm doing a lot of, I'm using comments in my manuscript to talk about stuff as if I were talking about it to a collaborator, even though the collaborator is just me. So I'm kind of thinking as future me as a collaborator. So as I'm writing the first draft, I'll highlight a section and open up a comment that says like, okay, so the reason I'm doing this is because I'm thinking that this, and this about the world, which, and I do it conversationally as if I'm explaining it to another writer. And that I think has been really good for me. It's been a new tool, and I think it's been broadening me as a writer.
Well, perfect. So thank you all for coming and for your great questions. You can obviously find him at TobiasBigel.com.
Yes.
He also has a Patreon if you are a fan of his work or just become a fan. It's patreon.com/TobiasBigel.
Yes. We're doing brand new stories there once a month. So it's like a short story subscription for your inbox starting at $1 a month. And you get a brand new Tobias Bigel story every month. And so far, people have been enjoying the stories. One of them just got picked up as a reprint.
Sweet.
For John Joseph Adams' Lightspeed magazine. I think that was Shoggoths in Traffic. It's the true story of why your GPS sometimes leads you on really weird and random looking routes away from your strip route.
Well, that's perfect. So thank you all, and thank you very much, Tobias, for an interesting conversation. Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Chronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.